Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 552, and I'm joined today by Marilaine Robertson. Marilaine's a comedian, and a comedian I'm a big fan of. And as we recorded this, she'd just been nominated in the top five most culturally influential Scots, which is mind-blowing. So we get into that a load. We talk about comedy, we talk about drugs, we talk about basically a load of things we probably shouldn't talk about. We talk about folk stories, we kind of talk religion and philosophy and all sorts of stuff. And that's the kind of person that Marilaine is. You just have wonderful conversations. Go and see Marilaine do their current show, Marge, on tour. They're going to be at The Stand in Edinburgh. I've not got any tour dates in front of me, but I know they're touring it about. So it's really good. As you'll hear, I talk about how much of a fan I am of it. This was the first time me and Marilaine had had a proper conversation. We'd chatted over the internet. I'd talked to Marilaine after shows, but it's always, I'm awkward in those situations. It was always just like, yep, good to see you. That was really good. Okay, I'm going to go off. Bye. So I reveled in this, and we could have talked for hours on end. Follow Marilaine on socials. I believe at one point we give out her social, but we maybe don't spell it. So I'm going to do that at the start. MarjoleineRobertson. Marilaine Robertson. Yeah, we're brought to you as ever by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. That's where you can get the merch and support the podcast. The weather is ever changing and terrifying at the moment, so you can get a full range of things over there, and we'll get it to you as quickly as we flipping can. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip is another way to support the podcast, and twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio, which is kind of how I met Marilaine. So head to all of those places and become part of it all, and make sure you're interacting and following on my socials. All I do now is Instagram stories, but if you're on the Twitch, then you get to be part of my Discord. I guess that's where I'm most active and most responsive. But let's get on with this conversation, because honestly, if you're not already familiar with Marilaine, you're going to be in love with her by the end of this. We also speak warmly of previous guest Barmer, so go back and listen to that episode if you haven't already. Until then, this is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 552, with Marilaine Robertson. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. I'm here today with Marilaine Robertson. How are you?
Good.
I'm excited to chat, because we've never really chatted. I've been in your streams, and we've bumped into each other outside of your gigs, and I'm the worst at bumping into person in the street conversation. I feel both times we've had a brief chat, and then essentially I've run away. So I'm glad we're going to have a nice, actual, relaxed conversation and get into it all. But how are you? How are you today? What's going on?
Good. It's been a busy couple of weeks. It's been a really good couple of weeks, actually.
Yeah. You're the third most culturally influential person in Scotland. How amazing is that?
I don't know if it's good to give me that kind of responsibility.
It's crazy. I was looking at it, and it's, for anyone who doesn't know, it's in the List magazine, and they do, the most influential cultural contributors. Young Fathers and Fern Brady above you. Two of just my absolute favourites. I had Young Fathers on my radio show back in, I think, 2006 or 2007. Just adore them. And Fern's have been on here. And then you. And you've beaten out, Gail Porter, The Proclaimers, Brian Cox, Lewis Capaldi, all these huge people. How's that feel? How is that?
Well, I think Brian Cox owes it to me, because I once bought him pants.
Really?
Yeah.
Explain this. Why did you buy Brian Cox pants?
It was a Shetland Film Festival screenplay, which I think was once in the Hot List 100. And I was a volunteer during the festival, and they're like, Marilaine, can you go pick up Brian Cox, please? And not going to lie, at first I was like, the science guy? What film has he made? So I went to the airport and then I sat in there and I was like, holy crap, that Stryker from X-Men 2. Yeah. And I was like, that Brian Cox.
Amazing.
So I picked him and he arrived. We went to go get a suitcase from the luggage area. To be honest, the airport in Chatham's just one room. And his suitcase didn't turn up. And I was like, oh my gosh, because he's such a big name, Hollywood name, incredible actor, long established career. And his suitcase never turned up. And I was like, I'm so sorry. And he turned to me, he's like, why are you apologizing? Don't worry, it's not your fault. And also, these things just happen. No, it's no problem. Like, he was just not
good guy, Brian Cox.
One hair out of place. He's just totally pleasant. He's like, this gives me an excuse to buy a Shetland t-shirt now. So he went to the tourist shop in the airport and he bought a bunch of Shetland t-shirts because he's like, I wanted to buy some souvenirs anyway. And then he went to the desk and he just was just like, oh, my suitcase is lost. Don't worry about it. But can it please be brought to this address when it comes? Like, the most pleasant man. Like, not bothered at all. So I took him to his accommodation and I was like, well, do you want me to fetch you some things for the immediate use, like toothbrush, toothpaste, things like that? And he's like, okay. So he wrote a little list. And I went to the supermarket and there's underwear on the list. And I'd watch him buy his t-shirt in a certain size. And I don't know if this is how underwear works, but I bought the underwear in the same size he bought the t-shirt, which is apparently way too big.
Yeah, that's a complex one to weigh up and balance, isn't it?
Men's clothes change like that?
Yeah, I don't really know on underwear because it's...
So I bought pants, but I think they were cartoon size big for him.
Yeah, I guess... Just men are really varied shapes, aren't they?
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. Like, you could have a big belly, but not necessarily a big waist. And I guess it comes down to waist with pants. It's how big your waist is.
Oh, okay.
I guess.
Yeah, because men can be triangular when they're wider at the top and then go narrow.
Yeah, exactly.
I did not expect that.
Yeah, it's confusing.
And I tried to find him some semi-decent pants in Tesco's. Because I didn't have time to go to a pant shop and I don't know where to buy men's pants in Shetland, actually.
No, I'd imagine not.
There must be a pant shop. Anyway.
Do you think the other Brian Cox would have been as relaxed about it, or do you think he would have proper kicked off?
He would have torn the airport down.
Just been fuming. Do you know how important I am? I've popularised science again.
Yeah, he would have gotten an asteroid to smash into that place.
Yeah.
Used his power of the stars. Take revenge.
I love the idea of him giving someone a real dressing down, but in his proper calm voice, because he's got the most calm and relaxed and lovely voice. But imagine him just really tearing someone.
What was that single again? What was the single Brian Cox did? Like, their
things
most
can only get better.
That would be perfect.
That's the big one, right?
Surely that should be his mantra.
I once did a spoken word gig. So a Professor Brian Cox and comedian Robin Ince used to do these nights at Christmas.
And they do a podcast now together.
Yeah.
Not to drop another podcast in on this podcast.
They're absolutely amazing. No, it's all friendly with podcasters, or it should be. It is here anyway. But I did their gig once, and I was just doing spoken word, and there was The Cure on the lineup, and Stuart Lee and Steve Coogan and all these amazing people, and I was on early, so I got to just do my bit, then sit down and just enjoy it all.
Yeah.
And as the big ending, Brian Cox did his big science speech and was talking about all the asteroids and all sorts of global warming and heavy stuff. And then he walked over and kind of a thing moved out of the way and there was a piano there. And the guy who was the singer in The Things Can Only, I can't think of their name
now. Is it E17?
No, it wasn't E17. Oh my gosh. Weirdly, he had a big puffer jacket on like E17.
Is that like...
It's a weird association. It's D-Ream.
D-Ream, sorry. And I was about to say someone else.
So he just started playing and he said, you know, it's all very doom and gloom, but surely things can only get... And the guy walked out and just started singing it and they broke into it. And it was the first time they'd performed it in like a decade or whatever.
Wow.
Because they stopped performing it. I think they broke up and then New Labour used that as their big theme tune. So now it's permanently attached to Tony Blair and... an illegal war in Iraq and all these other things. And they're like this nice band, these nice guys.
The downward spiral for us for a very long time.
Yeah.
What year was that you saw that in?
That was 2008 or 2009, I think.
When the recession hit.
Yeah. So that's why it needed to be a Things Can Only Get Better
but it's
type
not.
Vibe. No, it didn't really work. It didn't really make...
He needs to do it again.
A positive difference, yeah. But yeah, I love the weird... juxtapositions of things like that. How do you have a sense of arrogance as a Scottish person? Because you always seem to be on the right side of things politically, and it's the people down in England that are fucking it all up. Whereas you seem to vote positively for good things, whereas we kind of go, oh, Tories will be good fun, or now Keir Starmer, who's feeling like a new Tony Blair kind of thing, really centrist, really anti-left-wing stuff for some reason.
Oh, my gosh. Whereas that is just Scotland a Tory in sheep's clothing, that man.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it?
Firstly, I always think of myself as kind of Shetland before Scottish.
Yeah.
But also, I feel like we can feel constantly annoyed that our vote doesn't feel like it gets counted towards anything.
Yeah.
But I don't want to feel an arrogance, because at the same time, it's like, I don't know. You know, when you think, oh, I love my home, like I love Shetland so much, and you're like, oh, it's such a sweet, lovely community. But there are cracks there, and there's like opinions there that are like, oh, this isn't good.
Yeah.
So it's that idea of, I don't want to ever think like we're on the right side, because there's always more work to be done and more minds to be like opened.
I feel that. It's interesting, like, that thought of Shetland as a separate, obviously it is a separate thing from the main island of Scotland, but it's interesting that thought of a separate identity.
Oh, I don't think that's recording anymore.
No, that one's died, but this one seems to be.
Okay.
This keeps happening. I've had that a couple of times where it just goes error. So, you know, we've got no backup. So if anyone is listening now, they know that, you know.
I got a shiver.
They've got gold. It seems to be recording here. I was worried that might happen. I guess you being from Shetland is one of the reasons you're on that hot list, right? Because you do a lot of stuff about Shetland. I've been educated on it. I was torn on how we have this conversation, because do we do it in chronological order of your life, or arrogantly in chronological order of how I discovered you? Because I found you on Twitch first, in Rust, and then doing your folk stories, and then I've caught two of your fringe shows, and I've caught your word of the day things and things like this. So there's been all these weird different incremental new bits of information, but I guess they all have elements of talking about your culture and where you're from. So that influences it, right? It's because you tell these stories and get it out there that it makes a difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really helped. I'm happy to go from your version because I think that's quite interesting, because that's also interesting for me.
Yeah.
And I think you can sometimes tell your story so often that you almost go autopilot when you're telling it.
And particularly because it's part of your shows a lot of the time as well, because you have to kind of bring people on a journey. And again, I've seen your show 2 years in a row at The Fringe, and I loved both of them. But this most recent show, Marge, just I thought was such an astounding mix of folk tales and just real gut-wrenching storytelling at points, and laughs. Let's be clear, there's laughs as well.
There's a couple.
I thought it all melded together so perfectly. It felt like one of those shows where you go, yep, this is what it was building up to kind of thing, which is incredibly exciting. But yeah, so anyway, to go back, I first discovered you playing a game called Rust on a platform called Twitch. So I've had to explain what Twitch is to people on the podcast before. I've had to explain what Rust is on the podcast before. But I guess a nice way to explain that would be to ask you what appeals to you creatively about Rust for creating content or art or whatever you might call it. What is it that appeals about that weird little game?
Because when we started, it was just, I think, yeah, it's so funny because it's something I'm so passionate about, and I get scared a listener will just like log on to a random server and be like, this is horrible.
Yeah.
Because we had this like streamers and friends servers over different ones over the years. And as soon as we entered, it was like, you could just make a character and just role play as anything from like an actual, like just like you're in the game fighting, or you've got some kind of magic shop, or you're a traveling magician. Why are those both magic? It's just like just fully free platform. And you met in the game, you kind of were attracted to like-minded people, because as you went around role-playing, you'd find someone you just click with.
Yeah.
And for me, that was Bammer, big time.
Yeah.
Bammer. Also Roscoe. I already knew Roscoe, but every time you met Roscoe in-game, it was just as wonderful.
Because that's the beauty of it as well. You've got people like yourselves and Roscoe and Limmy, who started his own server and all that, who are comedians by trade. But then you've got people like Bammer, who on his own admission when he started that, he's just a bloke. But he's one of the most amazingly talented and creative. He's been on the podcast and I've raved about this to his face. But he's one of the most amazingly creative people I've ever met. And that's kind of what I love about things like that, is it's all these worlds overlapping. And Barman might not be right to do stand-up on a stage, but he's perfect to do these weird characters and tell these stories in this weird world.
Yeah.
But as you say, Rust on a lot of public servers is an absolute hellhole of racism, transphobia, misogyny, everything. It can be rough. But in the right world, in the right place, in the right locked-off server, it can be a creative dream, right?
Yeah. Oh, so good. And we even had a whole system going on during lockdown, because during the massive lockdown from January 2021, mm-hmm. At that point, my partner at the time, who's another comedian, so we're just pals new, but we're going out then, Gus, he was living with me. And people, A, didn't know, and B, he was playing Rust as well under a pseudonym called Quizman.
Right.
And he was bumping into people like Roscoe, and people he's known for his whole career, and like for like over a decade, I think, and playing this character to them, and they didn't even realise they were speaking to someone they knew.
I love it. So, I've definitely had that. I had one wipe, which again is like you have these kind of 2 week runs and then everything starts again. I had one wipe where I was just playing as a polar bear, and the amount of people that I've now chatted to a year on going, oh, that was you.
I didn't realize you were a polar bear.
I was just a polar bear for a bit. So, I mean, I was a person, but I changed my name to polar bear. I only growled at people. It was all for the kill feed joke. Yeah. So it could say, Barmer was shot at 100 metres with a bolt-action rifle by a polar bear. And it just seems confusing, but...
I have to admit, when I first saw your name in the Rust server, because was the first one, I remember, when you're building the church?
Yes, yeah, I built the Church of Love and Ruin.
Was that the same one as Coronation Street was going on?
Yeah, because yeah. I came and looked around Coronation Street, which you and Barmer and a few others were building Coronation Street in this game that primarily is about killing each other and surviving. But you guys went, no, we're going to build Coronation Street. Yeah. And you remained in character. If anyone came to visit, you'd be characters.
I was Sally Webster.
Yes.
I was like, Kevin, where's the girls? Because we were trying to make ourselves forest people and live in the trees. But every time we tried to build a treehouse, they collapsed, or we couldn't see what we're doing because of trees. And it's the only time I've ever seen Bammer lose it in a game. Amazing. So we made Coronation Street instead. And when I saw you were first on it, I was like, I thought it was somebody pretending to be you.
Because yeah. you get a lot of that as well. There's a Les Dennis in there. There's all sorts of people who are pretending to be.
It was a while when Bammer was Simon Cowell.
Yeah. Yes, I was there for that Russ Got Talent. There's going to be so many confused people here, but one of the greatest things was when you and Barmer started a cult, essentially. And that's something that people can go and watch on YouTube, right? I can't remember what you have to search, but it was, what was the cult called?
It was called The Community.
Yeah.
And basically, it all started because I was going to do it. When we knew the new wipe was coming, I wanted to do something special. I'd been talking to 10:30 behind the scenes where it's set in a cult, but 10:30 wasn't sure about what time he had. And then there's one brief moment when Lemmy was the son.
Amazing.
For like 15 minutes. And he's like, nah, and went to his own thing. And then I met Bammer. And before the cult started, in every wipe prior to that, Bammer would find me, invite me to whatever house of horrors he built, and he'd like kill me in different imaginative ways in the game.
Yeah.
So it would always be this like elaborate traps and a show and a feast and a dinner and meeting his family that were all skulls. It was just this mad, Bammer would make in-game worlds that he would take me into.
Yeah.
And we didn't know anything about Bammer. And so when I met him that wipe, I was like, he will be perfect to run this cult.
Yeah.
So I was like, do you want to be the sun and I'll be the moon? And we just built this community where the rules were we couldn't kill outside people, but we had to act really weird around them to make them really uneasy.
Yeah.
And but we killed each other in the cult all the time. And we made like the moon house, the sun house. We made all these different like the communal eating place, the communal dancing place, the wheel that would tell us what we had to do when we spun it. And then meanwhile, who built the harvest home? Oh, I feel so bad for forgetting, but one of the members had like taken so much time out to build this massive banquet hall.
Mm.
And then we eventually went for so long without killing anyone outside of the cult, but we kept getting killed by people that people started to think maybe they
aren't going to kill us.
Yeah.
So we invited everyone around for the harvest feast. And we let everyone keep their weapons on them as well. We're like, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But the entire building was a booby trap of death.
Again, if people just search Limmy Russ Server Harvest Feast on YouTube, it's beautiful because it's mad that Limmy is how I got into all of this. I'm a fan of him. He'd been on the podcast. It's how I found all of the Twitch stuff. But arguably the best thing that happened on his server, he had nothing to do with. It's this, like, there's this edit where it's cutting through all the different streamers. And again, I'm aware that we're 20 minutes in and there's probably been about 11 minutes that most people haven't got a clue what we're talking about because it's so inside baseball.
Put a link to the video so they can pause and watch.
We'll put a link to the video and go, that all makes sense. But
if it does.
It's a beautiful thing. And again, I think it's that open world nature of a game that allows people to create just this amazing comedy and art. And again, I talked to Barmer a load about the role play server of Grand Theft Auto. And again, Quiet City, there was a point that I was watching more of that than any TV show on TV. I was watching more of that than Netflix, than Prime, than all of these things, because it's just a load of creative people playing almost a 24-hour soap.
Yeah.
Like, you can log in it, or you can find someone who's streaming at any time and watch the magic that's going on.
And it's so clever because then when you log in, you can't know anything you watch on a stream.
Yeah.
So you have to be like, if I watched Bammer do a heist and then I log on.
Yeah.
Although I was never a police officer. And I log on, I can't know what went down. You just know if someone tells you in game. And it's just such a fun thing. But the most annoying thing is the reason I don't do it anymore is because my computer's up in Shetland.
Yeah.
It's not with me in Edinburgh. So I can't stream like I used to.
Yeah.
I really do miss that.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking. I've never joined one of the role play servers just because of intimidation of how good you and Barmer and everyone else are improvising. And my job is an actor. That's what I do as a day job. Yeah, it's like the improvise. Like I said, I'll tune in to any of you and it'll end all of a sudden I've watched 4 hours of a completely improvised story that reads like a drama or a farce. So, I mean, well, on that, what was it then with Twitch that made you go to doing things like Folktales and stuff like that? Because that was a really, I think you were one of the first people I saw, you and 1030, I guess, were two of the first people I saw who were doing stuff other than gaming on there. Again, I know there's a lot of people who listen will go, oh, I don't go on Twitch because I'm not a gamer. And you were some of the first people I saw that made me realise, oh, it doesn't have to be game. It's like that public TV thing you used to have in America. And like, it's just a way to stream whatever you want. So what made you start doing folk stories and stuff like that?
Yeah, because I always say it's like live YouTube.
Yeah.
So you get anything from like people doing wood carving to people doing watercolors, even people going on walks with just a phone. What happened for me was before lockdown, I was going through a rough time anyway, although no matter how rough things were going on, whenever I went on stage and did a gig, I was really happy. Mm. You know, like performing, they call, you know, Dr. Showbiz?
No.
I don't know if this is like a comedy specific term, but Dr. Showbiz is like, it doesn't matter how ill you feel, you can be spewing in the toilet.
As soon as
you walk on stage, you're fine.
Yeah.
Do you have a name?
Adrenaline is the best, is just the best medicine, isn't it?
Adrenaline, yeah. So I remember like, I was really just like emotionally unhappy and I wasn't really in a good place. But whenever I went and say, I was doing some of my best gigs at that point ever, because when I went and stage, I had full control of my life for like 10, 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then when lockdown kicked in, I was just a mess because of a number of things from the personal life. Like I'd split up with someone and then also lockdown, just everything was wild and I couldn't even read a book. I couldn't watch a whole episode of something. My brain was swimming.
Yeah.
And I was like, I need that. I need Dr. Showbiz, but how? And I'd heard, I think maybe Roscoe had started streaming and people had been talking about Twitch. And I used to watch Limmy stream from time to time. I never thought I'd stream myself. And I thought, I'll stream. But I was like, I do not have enough stand-up to stream stand-up and it won't be that funny. The Zoom gigs are horrible.
Yeah.
But then I was like, oh, what if I just told a story on it? And I thought I could, because I've got so many folk tales and I'm obsessed with folk tales. I've been collecting and chatting folk tales and stories fair around the world since I was young. And I thought, I'll go on and I'll tell some stories. And I just happened to be lucky that the second day I ever streamed, because I used to tell folk tales every day at 8 p.m. or thereabouts, the second day I ever streamed, I accidentally went viral on Twitter. Because I left my washing out overnight, which I always do in Shetland. And I went to go pick up in the morning and it was March and it was snowing and I couldn't find my t-shirt and my Iron Maiden t-shirt had blown off the line and blown up and got stuck in like the one tree in the area.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get my t-shirt out the tree. And I just made a stupid 20 second video like being angry at a tree. And it just weirdly went viral. And I remember when I posted it, I thought, I look like crap because I literally just woken up in my pajamas and was trying to get a t-shirt out of a tree. But because it went viral, I was like, come watch me tell a story. And that's what got folk in.
That's amazing.
And I think it was nice because I did it at 8 p.m. and originally my stream was really family friendly because I thought people might want to watch with their bairns. It's like a nighttime thing. It's a wind down thing. I was so chuffed to get that time because so many comedians were streaming then. We all kind of just out of nicety, like slotted in around each other.
Yeah, you try not to clash too much.
Yeah, so Amelia would kick
at
off
first,
the day.
Yeah. And then you stop caring. Because
yeah, I think at first in lockdown, it's like Amelia used to do the 9 o'clock stream and then about midday, Liam would do his crossword. And then I can't even remember all the slots, but then Ashley Manning came on and then there's a tea time slot. Then I would come on with story time. Then it'd be Gareth Waugh, CMB, then be Roscoe. So like, and then you could stagger it. And I used to keep my laptop on all day so I could hear people's voices in lockdown. Even if I was in another room in the house, it just felt nice. And so I just started telling a folk tale every night. Originally, it was only going to be a half an hour stream.
Yeah.
And then I would stream for like 4 hours.
I love it.
Well, one time 13.
I mean, tell me a little bit about Shetland. Again, you talk about it a lot in your work, but folk stories and folk tales, at least they all started as Shetland ones, and then you've done stuff from all over the place. But yeah, talk to me about it a bit. We were texting earlier and you joked about Aberdeen and it made me laugh because in my touring days of music, Aberdeen was basically the furthest point in the world. Because you think of, we're playing Glasgow and then we're playing Aberdeen. They're both in Scotland. It's a little bit further. It's so much further.
It takes and so then, long to get to but, Aberdeen, Glasgow.
But then Shetland is so much further than that. Yeah. It was kind of, in my mind, it's like, oh, Aberdeen, that's proper out in the outskirts. And you're far further in the outskirts. Yeah. So,
do you know how long it takes to get from Aberdeen to Shetland by boat?
No.
Do you want to guess?
I've not got a clue.
Guess.
From Aberdeen to Shetland.
On a boat. North.
You see, most ferries and things like that are like 30, 40 minutes, but yeah, I'm going to go with an hour. Is it an hour? How many hours?
It's 12 hours.
What?
It can be 14. And if it's bad weather, it can go up to 20.
That's genuinely mind-blowing.
From Aberdeen, you have to go 12 to 14 hours. So you leave Aberdeen at like 7 p.m. and you get in at 7 a.m.
That's insane.
And that's the quickest way. But the quickest journey will be 12, sorry, on boat. Yeah.
That's mind-blowing.
You can fly, but it's just so expensive.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And you grew up on Shetland, right?
Yes. So my mum's Dutch, but I was born and raised in Shetland. Mm. And spent most of my time there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really... How is it growing up kind of so detached from everywhere, I guess? What is it like on Shetland?
It's funny because you don't feel detached. Like for us, the mainland is mainland Shetland.
Yeah.
And you refer to Scotland as like Sooth.
Right.
And you refer to everyone outside of Shetland as Soothmuthers because...
As what?
Soothmuthers.
Right.
Because they come to Shetland via the south mouth of the harbour.
Yeah.
So it's like... So you feel like Shetland's so contained. And I mean, we're really lucky because I can go really into the history of Shetland. But because of the oil that started coming in the 60s...
Yeah.
I don't know how much you want a history lesson on
you
that.
You go in as much as you want.
Sure?
Yeah, we've got time. Go in.
I find it interesting. I don't know if your listeners find it interesting. No. Because my dad, he's an old man. He's 85.
Mm-hmm.
So he was born during World War II. So he was born in this way of life where they had no electricity or running water. There was like a phone put in up the road from them. And I think they were the only house to have a radio.
Yeah.
So the way that they lived their life of how they lived off the land and were almost entirely dependent off the land was the way they lived for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And when Dad went to university to study architecture, there was like rumours of oil being found off of Shetland. And Dad said he remembers times in Shetland with all these like oil tycoons and all these people would come to Shetland and just think of it like the Shire. They just thought Shetlanders were like a walkover, this like easy little hobbits. They could come in and make all the money from Shetland. But the man in charge of the council then was A.I. Tulloch. And he was really shrewd.
And he heard when BP was going to build the oil terminal, there were 7 different locations to build this huge oil terminal. And he found out the night they decided where they're going to build it. And he sent his council employees out like 9 p.m. that night to compulsively purchase all the land.
Wow.
And when BP wanted to build the oil terminal, he said, well, you can. He also had moved a motion to Parliament that went completely through with no difficulties, because I don't think they were aware of how big a decision they're giving us. But Shetland is one of the only places in the UK where we control our water edge rather than the Crown Estate controlling it.
Wow.
Yeah. So we control what pipes bring up what oil or electricity pipes. Yeah. So we have that control. So basically, he'd already gotten that through Parliament really early and very quietly. And then the day BP said, we're going to build our oil terminal here, he said, well, that's great. But you'll need our permission as the council, because it's our land and we control the shoreline. So you can build it. But for every barrel that comes ashore, we make so many dollars off a barrel.
Yeah.
And they had to agree.
Yeah.
And all that money was taken and put into a huge trust called the Charitable Trust. And that money was used to build schools and leisure centres.
Wow.
And build the economy. So in so many other islands, Dad said when he went to university in the 60s, it was common practice that unless you did teaching, you never returned to Shetland for your job, because there were no jobs.
Yeah.
And Dad was kind of one of the only ones of his generation to come back. And from then on, young people have returned to Shetland because there's jobs and money there now. So they could.
That's amazing. And it's such a exciting, again, it's I touched upon earlier of people in Scotland or further just doing things right politically, because that's an amazing example of controlling how oil is dealt with and looking after the area, making sure that the money goes to schools and leisure centres and all these kind of things.
Care homes as well.
Because for such a small area as well, it's like, I always remember hearing recently, a friend of mine made a film called 3-Day Millionaire, and he was talking about in Grimsby how they had what were known as 3-Day Millionaires, because Grimsby became this huge fishing port. And there was a kind of superstition that the money you make, so you'd make a load of money from going out and doing deep sea fishing. But there was a superstition that if, when you went back on the boat after the weekend, if you had any money left, it was bad luck. So these sailors all lived like millionaires on their 3-day weekend. So they'd literally have drivers and just all sorts of stuff. It was so over the top that they'd go and get suits tailored for them and all this. And literally, it was this amazing thing in Grimsby.
Brewster's Millions.
Yeah, it was this amazing thing that they'd just do at weekends, and they were kind of icons and legends. But then when they retire, they've got no money. But it was this mad thing of, it was, well, here's how we're living in our place. And I love stuff like that. I think it's so fascinating when there's things that are outside of how things are generally done, like where it's just the government making all the money or the rich are getting richer. It's so good to see places go, no, this is how we do it.
Yeah.
This is how it works here.
And I like with Silinvoe, with the oil terminal where it's built, because there's even older stories connected to it, like folk tales.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of stories of curses in Shetland. And when the lairds started taking over Shetland, like when the lairds started building, we call them the ha-houses. So right. Do you know about lairds? So Shetland's like all croft land, like lots of crofts, small farm holdings. Mm-hmm. And under our Norse rulers back pre the 1400s, you had the topmost stone in your hill to lowestmost stone in the sea. So you had a stretch of land down a hill face, and the width of it was proportionate to how fertile it was. So if you had really fertile land, you got a bit narrower. Mm-hmm. Really poor land, you got wider. So everyone could feed themselves and have their animals. And also you had the shared hills where the sheep all were shared, so everyone shared the grazing. And what happened was you would pay the laird. The laird technically owned it, and you were the crofter, and you'd pay the laird annually. And it used to be, they said, like in a pay of Bismarck of butter, mm-hmm. like under the more like Norse times or Viking times, if you want to call it that. But when you became under Scottish rule and the Scottish lairds came in, they built great big hall houses, like laird's houses.
Yeah.
And the payment moved into money. And there's also terrible increases, and also situations where lairds would kick people at their house and rip their house down so they could have more grazing, or even use that rubble to build their own ha-house. And there's a lot of hate against this. And one of the famous curse stories is a laird at Silinvoe, where the oil terminal is now.
and wanted to build this great big fancy house. And in doing so, they were clearing local people off the land.
Right.
He had his ransel men, his tough men, go into the houses and warn them. And if they didn't leave, they'd burn the thatch with the people in it. And this old man who was being kicked out of his croft said, "You can build your big house, but one day this ground will bleed black and there'll be fire in the sky."
Amazing.
And now a oil terminal.
Wow.
The oil comes up from the seabed up through the pipe to the ground, and there's a constant flare stack burning on the hillside. And famously, because the land was compulsory purchased, no local person made millions out of it. That money just went to all of Shetland.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that. And again, it's just, yeah, it's great having that history, the weaving. And again, it's what you did in your recent show, in most of your shows, I think, is weaving in folk stories and the modern time and reality and all of that. And that's, it's fascinating. Tell me a little bit about, so your dad came to study on the mainland as such, and you did the same. You came to Edinburgh to study and to do comedy, I guess. Like, what was your route into comedy? Because is there a lot of opportunities on Shetland for stand-up?
Not for stand-up, but there's a lot of comedy in Shetland because we have... Shetlanders are naturally inherently funny, and the stories they tell are so funny because there's lots sitting down and just yarning and speaking and telling funny stories, and just people are just having a laugh. Like, Shetlanders are so funny. And there's lots of festivals, like our Viking Festival with a big fiery procession. You may have seen photos of it up Helia. And there's about 10 or 11 of these festivals. And people always think the main part is the procession, the torches and the burning of the galley. And that's really important. And that is the main part in many ways. But then the night moves on to indoor celebrations where every group who is in the procession, we call them squads, they're all dressed in costumes and they go from venue to venue performing sketches and skits.
Oh, wow.
About maybe politics or popular culture or what's happened in Shetland over the last year. You find out all the gossip. like I remember friends of mine up north, their good pal left Shetland for a year to live in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So they thought, let's start a rumour about him and see how many squads in our local up Helia make fun of him. So they started this rumour that he was like ridiculously well endowed, like too well endowed. And there was two squads that were just about that.
Amazing.
it's just so funny. But how I got into comedy I studied archaeology at uni and I went back to Shetland and I was working full time and I was looking at doing a master's in planning and I felt like I lived away from home, but I'd only really been at uni for 4 years, and even then you're only away for a term and you're back home again because I'd always come home in the holidays to work to save up for uni again. And then my boyfriend at the time was moving to Amsterdam to study jazz and he's like, "Do you want to come with me?" And my mom's from Amsterdam, so I was like, I really should go and spend some time in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
So I moved with him. And when I was there, I joined an improv workshop. But I didn't have much money. And this is a bit of a mad story. I was telling it just the other day, actually, on another podcast. But I think that one comes out after this one.
Great.
But when I was in Amsterdam...
Which podcast was it?
Rahul Stippa.
How was
Richard
that?
Herring. So much fun.
It's the best, right? How long did Richard spend asking about your name and the pronunciation of your name?
He did once on the podcast, actually, and he said it right.
That's amazing. Again, I would have definitely picked him to be banging on about it for ages.
I think my voice was enough for him to bang on a bit. To be honest, I don't know why I can... Can I talk about illegal stuff on here?
Yeah,
okay.
Anything.
So before Rahul Stippa, me and... I won't name them. Me and a pal, we went for dinner. And I had dinner in the Japanese restaurant I go to frequently. But this time just was like, oh yeah, I know this menu. Ordered something, ate it. And only as I was finishing it, realised it was full of little shrimp. And I am allergic.
Oh.
And then I got to the whole stuff and I'd be like, also, I'd bought some chocolate with edible mushrooms in it for another time.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got into the whole stuff and I was like, so Richard, first time I ever met him, I was like, I just bought mushroom chocolate. And he's like, please don't eat before the podcast. I'm like, no, I'm not going to. I wouldn't do that. That would be irresponsible. But then I was like, but also you should probably know I did eat a bunch of shrimp and I'm very allergic. And he's like, what? I was like, if I run off stage to spew, it's not you, it's the shrimp. But it usually takes like 3 hours for the allergy to kick in, yeah. 3 to 4 hours. So I was like, I should be fine. I should be able to do mine, watch Ian Rankin, who's also chatting, yeah. and get home before I get sick. So I did the podcast, I was fine, watching Rankin's, and as I was walking home, I started to not feel that well. But by the time I got home, Ida Palo came over just to check in on me because they knew I was having a reaction. And we're sitting in the house, and I hand spewed, and I was feeling fine. And I was like, hey, do you know what I have in my bag? Mushroom chocolate. And the guy told me, if you eat an entire bar, you see through the fourth dimension. Amazing. But we were like, I just had a quarter, they had a quarter. And it was only when we were like had come up that we realized neither of us had ever done mushrooms before.
Yeah, that's a big first time.
But we had the best time. But we spent the because when I was coming up, I was sitting on the toilet and there was a book in the flat called Each Peach Pear Plum.
Right.
Do you know this book?
No, I don't.
It's a book for 3-year-olds.
Amazing.
And I read it on the toilet and I was like, that was intense. So I took it downstairs to my pal and we spent 3.5 hours trying to read the book. And every time we looked at it for a bit too long, we'd be like, and set it down. There's a part where when I went to the toilet when I was tripping and my face was hot, it was just like all red. And I was like, oh, I must be seeing myself for what I truly am. But actually, I was having an allergic reaction during the trip.
Yeah, the shrimp has kicked in. You see, it fascinates me. It's someone who's so into to history and folk stories. The first time you hallucinate is just on some chocolate in a flat while having a bad reaction to shrimp. When I used to love hallucinating, it was my favourite kind of drug as a youngster. But again, it was always just LSD and mushrooms and just all around someone's house, looking in a mirror and turning really old and just all sorts of weird stuff. But since I've stopped doing that is when like ayahuasca and all this stuff has come in, where so much of it is about the ceremony and the heritage. And it kind of breaks my heart a little bit because I'm like, I don't particularly want to try any of it again. I had a really good time. I'm kind of obsessed in my life with going out on top. So like I stopped doing music after my biggest album and biggest tour because I was like, right, cool. That feels like a nice time to stop. I stopped my club night in the same way. And drugs are one of them where I didn't really have a bad time on any drugs. Most people I know did at some point. So I felt like a really good kind of, I'm going to stop now. This feels like I've won. And that's the thing that lures me back constantly is the fact that it's now you can do such stuff that is more spiritual and more like historical and yeah. all this. And that fascinates because I had a really good time just doing cheap drugs in Essex. imagine walking up a mountain on these drugs or in the jungle or whatever else. So
yeah.
Although, that stuff fascinates me.
Have you ever heard about the ayahuasca ceremonies where actually traditionally it was like the elder would take the ayahuasca with your problem, they would go trip, then they come back and give you advice.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating.
So I don't know if we're actually meant to be taking it.
If we're doing it
or
right.
Or that's like a kind of like Western tourism into it. But I might be wrong about that.
I had a guy on the podcast recently who wrote a book called 10 Trips, and he did like 10 different kinds of trips, and some are walking up a mountain and some are in like a flat in East London. And that kind of stuff fascinates me because, again, the mixture of it all, it was learning that, I can't remember what drug he did up a mountain, but one of the key parts of ayahuasca, when you do ayahuasca, you do throw up. It's just part of it. It's part of the process. And he did this one drug on a mountain where their version of it, that drug's version of throwing up is laughter and crying.
Oh,
so
wow.
You will always just be in fits of laughter. It'll be this thing. It's like, that sounds like a much better one. Why are people doing the ayahuasca one?
That's what I was like on this one. I can't remember what this one was called.
Yeah.
But it was a very specific kind of mushroom that helps you go through dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
But we just giggled the whole, like we were laughing so much we were crying from laughter.
Yeah.
And we were also slobbering.
How much of that do you believe? Because this is something that fascinates me as well, because I've always been quite sceptical of a lot of spiritual stuff. I went to an all-boys Catholic school. I was brought up religious, but I don't have that now. But in recent years, I've kind of had a breakthrough that whether or not like I've done a few things in the last year or so that were these kind of spiritual journeys, and whether or not I believe I went to another dimension or I met my spirit animal or whatever else, what I learned in those moments was real. And that's all that really matters. And I've kind of, it's given me a break from religion and all sorts of things. Like, people will be so, can't believe they think there's a man in the sky who built all of this and whatever else. Like, it doesn't matter if they're getting good things from it. Obviously, religion has done loads of damage as well, but it's the same with folk tales, I think. You can 100% believe about the dolphin person that comes up from the sea, or you can just believe in what someone gets from that story or from that experience. Where do you sit on all of that?
I totally agree. I like, part of me, because I was raised Christian, and part of me wants to think that we continue forever. Part of me think that's a very vain ideology we build for ourselves. But then there's so many things you get of like echoes of other worlds or folk stories, where either the folk story, you can see where it comes from, a lesson from humanity, like Little Red Riding Hood, if you go to the original version of it, it being written for the courts in France, when it was traditionally the folk tale version. It's all about a young woman coming of age, and that's what Red Cloak symbolises, and it's about the dangers of predators. But then there's other folk stories that are just very much like, this is a fairy and this is a fairy world. So I'd love it to be true, and I think it's nicer to think there's creatures out there than to be alone in the hills. But I was thinking a lot about DMT. I've never tried DMT, but DMT and the machine elves. You know the machine elves?
No.
So many people talk about taking DMT.
The way you said you know the machine elves in the most casual way. You know the machine elves, right? No, I don't, Marilyn. I don't know the machine elves.
I'm scared I'm going to pick you on some slopes to try more drugs. So I've never come across them, but a lot of people talk about DMT, which is the chemical released when you die in your brain. And a lot of people take a DMT trip, but they all say it can be very intense because you do go through your life. Your life flashes for you and you have to deal with every moment. And often the moments that will probably flash the strongest are the most visceral or emotional or traumatic moments. But they say when you go through this enough, you end up in the doorway, and you go through the doorway and there's like, they call them machine elves because they're kind of like humanoid creatures, and they just hold things in front of you that they're showing you wonders of the world. And maybe you understand what they're holding in front of you, maybe they don't, but they just keep showing you things. Then it's humanoid figures and it's very spiritual. It's like this amazing connection.
Yeah.
And when you're there, then it feels like a while, but you come out and you've just been tripping. And I've been thinking about it a lot, and the conclusion I've come to sometimes kind of makes me sad. But so many people have tripped and seen the machine elves. And then the machine elves as well kind of sounds the same as the stories of people being abducted by aliens. You know, in the 50s when they're like, oh, I was walking in the woods and aliens abducted me. I was taken somewhere and I saw these strange creatures holding strange things in front of me.
Yeah.
And they come back. Or if you go further back in time, the stories like I tell about, oh, I was walking through the hills of Shetland and these creatures of the hills took me in these troughs, these grey-skinned creatures. Or like in Ireland, you have fairies. Mm-hmm. Or the elves in Iceland. Or the Patupairihi in New Zealand. Like, every culture has this version of these creatures. And I was like, is it just that DMT takes you so far back in your memories? It takes you back to the eyes of a baby when you're not fully forming what you're seeing yet, and adults are standing there showing you a rattle or bringing you a bottle or coming with a swab to touch you. And it's like you're actually going right back to memories you didn't even know you stored, of looking at a world that you don't yet fully comprehend.
Yeah.
And that's why I wonder if the machine elves are, because when you think about it, so many stories of alien abduction or meeting fairies are people out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Have they gotten some kind of exposure or hypothermia, or if they hit their head and they've almost died.
Yeah.
They've seen this like flashback of DMT going through their system in that moment.
Yeah.
And then there's somehow these people, like, whether they fell over and fell asleep, but they woke up in time before they passed away and came home. And they just had this DMT trip of almost death that led them to think they were in a fairy realm.
Yeah.
And I don't want that to be true, because I'd rather they'd been in a fairy realm.
There is actually these fairies, and
but is it actually just our first concepts of looking at adults when we're a baby?
Yeah, and there's often, particularly with the alien ones, there's often a looming over, there's often a height, all this kind of thing. So that really ties
probing
in
you because they're changing your nappy.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think that's fascinating.
Like, they always talk about, like, the aliens like inspected me, and I was like, maybe it's like early memories of being bathed by your parents that you don't remember.
I love it. It's interesting. And again, I think all of those things. I think at points it can be a bit of a bro thing to be going, it's the chemicals that are already in you, man. Like, it's all good and all things like that. Because I don't think it necessarily matters. There's loads of things that we improve our minds and bodies with that aren't naturally in us, that, you know, they're good for us to intake. But yeah, anything that can activate memories, because memories is one of the most fascinating things that we don't understand, I think. And that ties exactly in with dreams. Again, I find dreams absolutely fascinating, because I don't put any particular meaning in them, because I don't understand any of it. But dreams are fascinating. I'll regularly wake up and just take a while, just kind of going, fuck, that was all kind of mad. And again, that fits in with, I think, because I did a load of hallucinogens in my kind of teens, early 20s, and I feel they had a positive effect on who I've become, it therefore gives more of an openness to try and pay attention to dreams and what they are, and kind of take it in a bit. Even though, again, I'm not someone who has, you should look that up in a book and see what it means. It's like, the book doesn't know what the dream I had about 10:30 a couple of nights ago means. Book's never heard of 10:30, but yeah, I love all of that stuff. Same. It's fascinating.
I do too. And it's like, I like when, like in Shetland, we have different meanings for different dreams. Like, if you dream of boats, but they're traveling in on the land, that means death's coming, like someone's going to be taken away. But yeah, I have lots of really vivid dreams. One of my first dreams ever was me picking to come down to this part of Earth, looking like through the clouds and coming down. And yeah, that was a mad dream. It was like, we're in the clouds, and then you picked where and when you went, and you went down this almost like pole of cloud, but you kind of like skated around it.
Mm. I love that.
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
And that's where you picked like your family and stuff.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
I can't remember where we were that we've taken ourselves off on this tangent, but that isn't important. But
I think I was talking about Amsterdam.
Yes.
And then we mentioned Richard Herring.
When you went to Amsterdam and you joined an improv group.
Yes, and then basically, I was telling a story in this podcast, that's how you understand.
I can't believe Richard Herring is derailing this podcast as well as his own. He derails his own podcast constantly. And now he's somehow derailing other podcasts.
I've not heard from him, because I've emailed him about the mushrooms, so I've not heard back yet. But so in Amsterdam, I had this job at a restaurant, and I never like lived in a big city apart from studying in Edinburgh, which is very different. So I had this job where I was working like 12 days a week, like 11 to 12 hours a day, but the boss didn't really want to pay me less. He wanted to pay me under minimum wage, like half minimum wage.
Wow.
I should be making a lot of money from the hours I put in. The flat we were renting, then one night when we were visiting my family in another part of the country, the landlord like put all our belongings to black bags and just kicked them out, because apparently we weren't meant to be in the flat, because he's illegally subletting to us.
Wow.
Which we didn't know.
Wow.
But we should have guessed, because he was sleeping not in a bedroom but on a couch beside our bedroom door. We were in his room. And then I spent ages trying to find a job. I remember applying to McDonald's 3 times, and every application I wrote like all these long answers. And the third time I applied to the job, when it said, why do you want to work at McDonald's? I just said, I really like the food. And then I got the job. But it was just like, we're sleeping on friends' floors for ages, trying to find a house for ages, trying to find a job for ages. And I've always been someone who's always had a job, sometimes multiple jobs. I just work a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it all really difficult. And eventually got a house. I got my job at McDonald's. But, I got a free place in a storytelling course where I went and lived in a nunnery for a week.
Amazing.
With a bunch of nuns.
I love it.
And it was the World of Peace Storytelling School, or the International Storytelling School for Peace. And it was amazing, because the collection was like, there's me, a Dutch person, Moroccan, German, Polish, Palestinian, Israeli, like this huge group of us all together in this building. And it was really, this was back in like 2014, because it was really interesting. It was really interesting, and we were all like telling stories. But the way they made us pick our story is they made us think of 7 things that make home home, and you had to give each thing an item. So if home was comfort for you, you might write bed. Mm-hmm. If home was security, you might write front door. If home is family, you might write photo albums, like whatever you associate with that thing.
Yeah.
And we also write 7 things that make us ourselves. and you wrote this list of 14 things and you had to tell everyone in the group why each of these things was important to you. And the first exercise they made us do was pick up the thing we care least about, say thank you, goodbye, and get rid of it forever. And they made us just get rid of all these things. And the first year, easy. Then it got hard. And when you get to like the last three or four, it was, you couldn't choose anymore. But they made you choose. And I got really upset. And they're like, no, you have to choose. And I was sitting there looking at these things and I could hear other people crying around me in the room. And when you eventually went to one thing, the one thing you had left in your life, that's what you told the story about.
Wow.
And so it was a really intense week, but it made you learn that the importance of items in your life are just the emotional attachments you give to them a lot of the time. Because a week after I came back from that storytelling course, we got robbed.
Right.
Our house got robbed. And they took my fiddle, my bass, my laptop, my camera, which I was making sketches and films and documentaries on as a way of supplementing my income and doing something I love.
Was it the nuns? Did they come and rob you? Did they basically get an item list off you in this system? Here's the physical things that mean the most to me. Here's the one thing I need. And they come around and take all of it.
And just leave a Gideon's Bible in the place.
You're like, you're fine. You threw it away. Threw it away last week. You don't care about it, really.
Yeah. Thank you for staying. This is the payment.
Yeah. Jesus.
Is who they're working for.
Yeah, exactly. He's leading it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So it was wild. So it was like one bad thing after another in that country. But the storytelling course really helped me to process losing things.
Mm.
But the school, the Easy Laughs, the improv school, felt so bad for me with the robbery. And they knew I'd had a tough time anyway. And they knew I had no money. So they said, look, there's a stand-up course. You'd said you're interested, but you couldn't afford it. And you're meant to pay up front before you could do any courses. And they're like, look, just join in and pay as and when you can.
Yeah.
Just in dribs and drabs, pay us for the course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're like, all you need is a pen and some paper. So I stole that from my flatmate. Because their students had heaps of pens and paper. Yeah. And then I started doing stand-up.
That's amazing. Like that. That's a hell of a journey into stand-up, right?
Yeah.
And how's it kind of been since then? Because obviously we've touched upon the pandemic stunting things and you had to go back to Shetland at that point. How was it to get back to things like the Fringe? And how often are you in London? Like, we're recording this in London. Yeah. How often is this a trip that you make? Again, it seems like an insane trip now, but considering how long it takes just to get to Aberdeen from Shetland. But you're in Edinburgh now, right?
So yeah. So this feels like nothing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a breeze.
You can get, this is like going from one end of Shetland to the other with the ferries.
Yeah. Because
I'd done that 1 year of stand-up before London, and I think I was really fortunate because to leave Shetland to do stand-up full-time was going to be such a huge commitment. And the last time I left Shetland before that to live somewhere was to go to Amsterdam, which was so difficult.
Yeah.
So I was like, I never want to move away from home, which I love so much, unless it's truly a decision I'm making that will be something I want to explore.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So I knew I wanted to know that I could A, do stand-up, and B, wanted to do stand-up. So I did three PBH free fringes, three summers in a row, to see if I had what it takes to do stand-up and if I enjoyed it and enjoyed the grind. So after the third fringe, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'll move. So I was between every fringe just working at home and saving up money and saving up money. Because also when you start doing stand-up, you don't get paid for years, which makes sense because anyone can call themselves a stand-up comedian. You need to graft in each individual club till the club will pay you. So because there's no monitoring, there's no qualification. Yeah. And you're also only as good as your last gig.
Of course.
You can be a shit hot comic 10 years ago, not do stand up for ages, and then not be gig fit anymore, or your material's dated, or you've not written anything. But yeah, so I moved in January 2019. January, February 2019. I think I moved in on the last day of January. And just, even though I'd done three fringes, I just applied everywhere for open spots, for fives, for new material nights or new comedian nights, because I knew I had to graft, because doing an hour show, I find hours easier, but actually my hour is very loose, sporadic, not many punchlines within the whole hour kind of story.
Yeah.
And I needed to get sharp.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? A a 5 minute or a 10 minute can be harder because you have to really distill everything down. It's what, as stupid a leap as this sounds, it's what I originally loved about Twitter when it first came about, is you had to distill, you had a certain amount of letters. So anything you want to write that's a joke or stupid or funny, you've got to really trim all the fat. And then here it is.
Yeah. I used to actually, my first few Fringe shows, go through my Twitter and pull funny tweets I'd written out.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, those are jokes.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to do that. I used to go back through Twitter and use it. Not anymore.
Yeah.
Thanks, Musk.
It's horrible there now, but
oh, it's terrible. But yeah, so that was my first way into it. And then I had a year, and I was quite fortunate because I'd done so many Fringes. I had a lot of, like, I was used to being on stage in a stand-up way. And I'd done a lot of drama in Shetland when I was younger. So I think I was used to being on stage and I had a lot of jokes that I could whittle down into 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And also, I forgot the other one. But basically I was used to being on stage and, oh, awesome, from Shetland. So like you said before. So I had this like unique viewpoint compared to a lot of the other stand-ups around me. So I kind of quickly progressed. But not that quickly when you consider I'd spent 3 years doing Fringes. But so within a year, I was getting like paid gigs, which was nice.
That's amazing.
And the first month I was going to make money out of stand-up and not use my savings was March 2020 with my projected gigs. And then all those gigs fell through and I went home.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's rough. Do you feel that you came back all the better, if you know what I mean? Because having it kind of taken away and having that time in literal isolation for a lot of people, did you feel that gave you a chance to refine things, or do you feel that period not gigging meant you had to kind of start again almost to get, as you say, gig fit?
That's really interesting. I never thought about it like that, because I think I remember being so pleased with all my gigs in January, February, and the beginning of March of 2020. I was like, oh yeah, I feel really good about how I'm gigging right now. And this is good. And I'd started working on my show for that Fringe. Although I looked at my notepad and genuinely, because remember the wildfires in Australia in January 2020, I wrote, there's one page I was trying to write jokes and I'd written so many failed jokes and I just wrote, how can I write a joke with the world's ending? And the lockdown happened. But I don't know. I think I've never thought about it, but I think it's because of Amsterdam. It's like when things happen that are bad, you can't live in the what if of what it would have been.
Yeah.
So perhaps a lot didn't ever happen. I just kept going up and up and up. But then also I think sometimes a period of reflection is really good for helping you step away and get a viewpoint and material. Yeah. Like the show I was writing in 2020 is the show I'm writing for this year's Fringe.
Right. Wow.
That subject matter is the one that because I didn't do it after lockdown because I want to talk about ADHD. Well, I want to talk about the one I did in Marge, but I talked about ADHD instead, and then I did Marge. And now I'm going back to that show with like a different viewpoint and a different way of writing it as well.
It's really interesting how ideas and art can work, because I do feel there's something about incubation periods like that. I find like if I'm learning lines for a role, I will drill them for a bit one evening and then go to sleep. And when I wake up, I'm far better at it than when I went to sleep, if you know what I mean. Because there's something, it's that getting it in your head and getting your head going over it. And again, I feel that's the same if you were working on a show and bits and stories, and then you've suddenly got a year, 2 years, that they're still going to pop up every now and then in your head, and they're still going to be developing and evolving and maybe getting better than if you'd had to perform them in a month or that Fringe. That August kind of thing. So,
And I think distilling is the perfect word for it, because I've actually started writing, such a nerd, I've started writing 2025 show.
Amazing.
Because I think with Marge, that show I was meant to do with Thank God Fish Don't Have Hands, but I pulled it back and then did it this year. And I think it's all the better for it. But also, it was quite an emotional story to write about, and I had to know how I felt. And 2025 show, I was like, oh, that one's going to have a while to sit in my brain. So I purposely spent a few days working on that. Mm-hmm. So now I can steep and just like distill, like you say, it's the perfect word for it. Will I go back to working on 2024 show?
It was the beautiful advantage of writing albums, like when I was doing music, because a lot of my lyrics would be quite personal, but the nature of the music industry, particularly at that point, is quite slow. So I'd pour my heart out into these songs, and then I'd have a good few months while the records are getting pressed and all these different things. before we're having to tour them and perform them.
I never thought about
that. To become comfortable with it and for it to become its own thing. It's a performance now. It's no longer my heartbreak or my depression or whatever else. It's now a performance because I've had that period of pouring my heart out and then stepping away for a bit and thinking about all the boring business sides of it, of what order the songs are going to be on an album and which ones we're going to do live and all that. It stops becoming this... Yeah, weirdly, it stops becoming such a personal thing. We're going to have to start wrapping things up in a minute.
Oh my gosh, how long has it been?
We've done over an hour.
Oh my gosh, it feels like half an hour.
It flies by. Like, but there's two things I definitely want to kind of talk about before we wrap up. I've ignored most of the things on here. There's a third thing at the end I'm going to ask about. But so the two things are, and this is all just going off things that you've said, how do you feel about prudishness and its effect on art and society? And let me explain where this has come from. So you mentioned, and it's true, so many of the original folk tales and folk stories will have an element of sex or sexuality or coming of age, of all these things. And it's been rubbed out so much because you can't talk about that kind of thing. And one of the things I enjoyed and was surprised about in coming to see both your shows was, again, I knew you from doing are these weird characters in Rust and then these folk stories. And sex and sexuality is, you know, part of your shows and part of what you talk about. And that's a positive thing. But again, it's weird in 2023 that at times that feels like a brave thing. And again, it's such a cliche to say, particularly for a woman, to be talking about these things in such an open and honest way. I guess, how important is that? Is that a conscious thing that you feel we need to address this more? Or is it just, well, here's the story I needed to tell at the time?
Yeah, there's definitely still a kickback sometimes if you go too rude too quickly. And I say too rude, I don't think you really can go too rude. I think especially when you're talking about your own personal experiences.
Yeah.
And especially when it's a fringe show, it's like, hey, this is my hour. Mm-hmm. I think once a man speak to me after a show and say, oh, do the girls think they have to be like guys? I was like, what do you mean? And it had been a mixed bill of several comics, like maybe 6 comics and all, because New Material Night. And it's like, just all the girls were just so much more rude and they all had to talk about sex. And the guys didn't do that. And it actually, it wasn't like that. It was just everyone was talking, but he was more...
They're noticing it more.
Noticing it with
out
women.
Out of this voice, out of this mouth. Yeah.
But when he said that to me, I was so taken aback. I didn't say that. I was like, oh, well, I think I've got a right to say whatever I want on stage. Yeah. I just have a responsibility to know what I talk about on stage, and I think it's really important. I have a responsibility to know whatever I talk about on stage can often, people think of it as a green light for what they can say. So even if I was trying to make a really like clever point about, say, transgender rights, if I'm doing it in a club set on a night of drunk people in the audience, people might not follow or understand my point and then take this as a green light to make some crappy joke.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I think you always have to be aware of like...
People laughing in the wrong way.
Yes. Or like maybe they hear your joke and then think they can then go say some...
Yeah.
I just feel like you need to be so careful.
But again, just on that, I couldn't agree more. Like one of my favourite comedians is Anthony Jeselnik, and he talks about all sorts of horrible things, but it's because it's so well crafted that it works. And then you see people who are fans of him just... Because his stuff's offensive... They think that's the joke.
Yeah.
And they will just say the most offensive shit. And it's like, no, that's not funny now.
No.
What was funny was how he crafted it, the way he made you think he's going to go this way and then he went that way. Just saying the offensive thing. I think I've spoken to Frankie Boyle about this because I think he's been responsible for some of that in the past. He'll write these amazingly well-written offensive jokes and so many people in offices and in jobs will just think the funny thing is rape or the funny thing is murder.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, that wasn't the joke. It was how it was crafted. Yeah. And I think that's a key differential.
Yeah, which again is why I always prefer fringe shows, because the fringe show, you've got the audience for an hour with you.
Yeah.
So you can go to some weird topics because you have them for an hour to speak to them about that exact thing. But I do think there is a kickback sometimes when you're rude or talk about sex, and it's just like, why? It should just be a normal topic of conversation. I think I'm always so encouraged by the younger generations coming through when things like consent are talked about more. Mm-hmm. I think the more you talk about things like sex and talk about like weird sex things or kinks, like no shaming or anything, makes people realize that this is an okay thing to talk about.
maybe when they meet someone and they go on a date and they want to have sex, but it's like, oh, we should talk about it first. See what we're into. And it's just like, it should be a conversation piece. Maybe you're not into it. That's cool. But it's just the more we're open about it and the less taboo it is, I think the safer it is.
I was going to say exactly that. I genuinely think there's so many, there's podcasts like the Fucks Given Come Curious podcast, Sex with Charlie and Nina and stuff like this, where it's so important for women and in the Fucks Given case, for sex workers to talk about their experiences and laugh about these things so that it's not this hidden taboo thing. The reason we get all these fucked up primarily men is because they don't understand. And they've all they've seen is this one bit of porn or this one thing and one that, and they don't understand all the nuance and all the consent that needs to be there and all these different things. So, yeah, I think it's hugely important to talk about these things. And as you say, it makes the world safer. It might have a little bit of discomfort because you might be listening and someone else is in the room and it's suddenly a bit awkward, but that's better than the negatives.
Yeah, and I always be responsible and be like, well, you age your show appropriately to the content you're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's 18 plus for a reason. And then I remember there's been folk who've brought bairns and children into my show before. And then the venue manager's been like, what do you think? And I'm like, well, you can go tell the parents that I talk about this and I'll say these words.
Yeah.
And then they've been cool like, they've gone and left. Because it's also like, it's just like, A, I want to be comfortable saying the material. If there's a child there, it makes me feel inappropriate for saying this from a bairn.
Yeah.
Also, the man's like, no, we're cool with it. But then it's like, well, is the audience cool to laugh around that bairn? Because then the audience feel uncomfortable
Yeah. Well, again, I'm just keeping adding things I want to talk
Please
about. But can we just talk quickly about
the more
language?
We talk, the more we get through rush hour and the easier it is for me to travel. So I'm fine.
But language is something that's again, I love your word of the day things and stuff like that. And again, you're the first person I've researched that's had a Wikipedia page in a different language.
Oh, yeah, the shit one.
Yeah, which I've never had that before. And it was like, oh, cool, this is kind of interesting. And growing up with Scottish family, I always remember how... And we saw this with Irvin Welsh, basically, when his first books came out, people were like, oh, hard to get your head round. It's like, it's not when you actually just listen. I have it all the time. I've got a stutter. And there's a lot of people who the first few times they listen to my podcast, it's like, I can't listen. Like the stutter really brings me out of it or jars me or whatever else. You get 4 or 5 episodes in and you don't hear it anymore. Yeah. It's like my friends and family don't particularly notice. I've had podcasts before that I've recorded. I've had to go back in to check something. And I'm like, oh man, I didn't realise I was stuttering for this whole section, you know, and things like that. And I think that's the same with so much language, right? There's been numerous things that you will have said in this conversation that the first time someone heard the word, they'll go, I don't know what that is. And then the more it's been used, the more you just, oh, I now know what you're referring to. And so, yeah, I guess how important is language to you and how important is keeping your language?
Oh, super important. I know it's called code switching. That's what I do.
Okay.
Code switching is when you, the Shilton word for it is canap. Canap is when you spoke to be understood.
Yeah.
So canapping is like, right now if I talk like this, I'm canapping, I'm speaking more English.
Yeah.
But then if I was to go more Shetland, and maybe when I speak about Shetland, I would naturally start slipping into the dialect and the way of speaking in Shetland. So that's code switching. So sometimes people have been like, she's a hypocrite, because sometimes I speak in Shetland, sometimes I speak more English.
Yeah.
But that's just, I'd naturally... Most people do that with talking to different people.
Yeah.
But I think it's so important to keep a dialect in Shetland, because it was a language called Norn. And now it's Shetland dialect is a mixture of our Norn language, Scots, Old English, a bit of Dutch. or maybe that's the kind of the Nordic words. But I think because there's Dutch fishermen who like came to Shetland around the 1600s, especially when we were being anglicised.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a period in Shetland when many Shetlanders were like trilingual because they would speak Norn, Scots and Dutch. And I just think it's really important because there's so many words in Shetland that only exist in Shetland. And also there's so many parts of the language, like when you're crofting and working with the sheep or when you're fishing or even just like everyday life, it adds, the mother tongue is such an enriching way of your... keeping our culture alive.
Yeah,
like it's literally on your breath. It's part of your life. And I think it's such an important thing to preserve. And I mean, for generations, if you spoke Shetland in school, you got trouble. You may speak English. And this is something that they've just stopped doing. But now the way they teach bairns and children to read is phonetically. So I'll hear the most broad-speaking Shetland bairns going to school. And this is the one thing that like makes me see it ahead is when folk are like, yeah, but they need to learn how to speak English. It's like, yeah, they can speak English too when they need to. I just think that's the most like weird colonial snobby thing that someone who's so basic will say.
Yeah.
Then like, oh, but how can you speak English? There's a girl at my uni.
England is one of the only countries who only speaks English.
Yeah.
Only speaks one language. Like bilingual nations are so normal. And I think it's because we're this weird little island.
Yeah.
I think if you've got borders everywhere and you're crossing and mixing, then everyone speaks. Yeah.
And then they all use English as like a universal.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Many do. So it's bad. But now I hear the most Shetland speaking bairns going to school and immediately coming out speaking really like proper English because that's how they learn to make the sounds to then read the birds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like breaking my heart because I'm like, although they're encouraging bairns to speak Shetland in class now, when they read, they immediately read in English.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to have this like quite strong effect on many bairns. But saying that, like my mom's Dutch and I was so obsessed with Sooty and Sweep Sue. I would speak really English on purpose as a bairn for like ages. I was like, hello.
Because of Sue.
Yeah,
love
because
it.
Of Sue Bear. And it drove my family up the wall. But like, I think that if as long as folk are actively speaking Shetland, it's got a good stronghold. And I love it as well when folk move to Shetland and they start using Shetland words or pronunciations. I think that's absolutely brilliant and should be encouraged. Because even if you have a different accent, but you're using words like piri or even some pronunciations like rund the corner, then it's nice. It keeps it alive. Yeah.
I love it. I do.
And when I'm not in Shetland, if I meet another Shetlander, it's so nice just to speak broad Shetland because it feels like just relaxing.
A release.
Yeah.
I've found for ages a lot of my mates had kind of joke about how antisocial I can be. And I love being around people. I love my friends, but I will really enjoy being at home. And I've realised that part of that is because I'm not having to fight my stammer anymore.
Oh, wow.
Because weirdly, it's kind of the opposite of that. I just have silence and I don't have to think about that. And as soon as like all my family have upgraded their TVs or whatever to these ones that you can talk into and request stuff, it's like, I'm never doing that because this is the time where I don't have to worry about trying not to stutter as I'm requesting a TV. It's like, I'll type it in.
Yeah. I never thought about that.
Yeah, it's weird because it's a funny one because although I'm perfectly comfortable with it, and again, on the podcast, we never edit out any stammers or stutters. It's a perfectly natural thing. But exactly as you were saying, you are going to naturally, when you're around people, try and kind of put a handbrake on a little bit and try and find ways to not stammer as much and not stutter as much. Similar as you'll speak more English and things like that. So it is nice to take the handbrake off and not have to think about that.
I think also like I'm speaking way more English than I normally would because when I do stand up, I canap, I code switch. Because I used to kind of sometimes speak in dialect, but even in Glasgow, I remember drunk people being like, what is she saying? Like not understanding me when I'm on stage. And I'm like, well, I can't afford to lose anyone in the setup because then the punchline won't make sense.
Yeah,
so I just have to just... And then I come off stage and folk are like, oh, you don't sound Shetland. And I'm like, oh. But if I did speak my Shetland accent, you wouldn't have understood me.
You wouldn't have all got the jokes. Yeah, that's really interesting when communication is absolutely key to what you do. But again, I think it's why, you know, as we said at the start, number three in the Hot 100 list, it's you putting the effort in to find that balance is what makes it important because you are kind of going, look, this is my heritage, this is this, but I don't think only people on Shetland should know about this or should be able to understand this. Yeah. This should be for everyone. There should be a wider spread there. Well, I mean, to wrap things up, are you doing a podcast? You and Barmer have talked about doing a podcast. Hasn't happened yet. So again, this is just for my, this isn't even for the listeners now. I just want to know what's going on.
As soon as I was thinking about Bama, I was like, oh my God, a bit of a moment. How many episodes have you recorded now? I need to message Bama because I left my podcasting equipment in Shetland.
Right.
In the most ridiculous move, because I was meant to be in Shetland for the whole of September. And I was like, great, I can message Bama, the fringe is over, I can record some episodes. I've got time. Might have hurt my belly then. and then I had to come down to London all of a sudden for some work in September. So I flew down without my car. And then it was only like when I came back to Edinburgh in October, I was like, oh my God, I can't even record the podcast with Bam because all my stuff's in Shetland. So I was thinking, I wonder if I can like do a bunch and we can do it next year because I love what we've recorded so far, but it's mad because every time we've recorded an episode, 6 months has gone by.
Yeah.
And it'd be nice to just do it regularly because I also just enjoy speaking to Bama. It's just so much fun. The podcast is ridiculous. Has he told you what it's about?
What is it? No,
it's called A Bit of a Moment.
Yeah.
Because we're always like, I'm having a bit of a moment because something always happens.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we even, I don't want to say what it's about, but I almost feel like we should because maybe that would, because what we do, I'm just going to say it. And then this will mean I do it. We've been picking a letter of the alphabet. Well, we've just been running through the alphabet. So the first episode was A, then we're on B, then we're on C. I don't know if you've even recorded C, but we both pick a word from that letter.
Yeah.
And we tell a story connected to that word.
I love it.
And then we just laugh about the stories. And I think we were trying to get, wanted to get listeners to send in words for the next letter of the alphabet. We have to speak about those words. Mm. So it'll either be C or D. So I think, but I just think we should kick it off. But we're meaning to kick off a few times and then just life gets in the way. And then I'm really bad because closer it gets to the fringe, I get very stressed. And then August, I'm completely out of the game. And when I thought I'd have a full month of September to get back into things, I'd come down here for gigs, which was great.
Yeah,
but
of course. Well, I've made you talk about it on the record now.
Yeah,
so
we have to get out.
But
I hope we get out because a bit of a moment's so nice. And I want to keep working with Bama because he's so funny.
It's great.
And it's also just nice to speak to Bama regularly.
Of course. Exactly. Having a regular appointment. Again, it's why I love this podcast because it forces me to have these really big conversations with people that I wouldn't have. As said, we've touched upon how antisocial I am. This is perfect to go, no, for work, I have to really enjoy a conversation. So where can people keep up to date on everything that is ahead? You're on the socials, right?
I'm best at Instagram.
Instagram, yep.
There's always one I'm best at, another slide away. So I'm best at Instagram for putting up gig listings. I'm putting up my December gig listing probably in the next couple of hours. Wait a minute. When does this podcast go?
This is going out in the new year. So forget December
forget
listings.
Forget December.
But there'll be other listings.
Oh.
And where are you
if it's
socials?
A new year, I've got a website. I'm Marilyne Robertson on Instagram. And my website's marilynerobertson.com or Marilyne Robertson
on Facebook.
And
that's MarjoleLein. I'll
yes,
do that again. MarjoleLein.
Perfect.
Robertson.
I was so excited to have my first ever film clip of the Top Secret Comedy Club because they make clips of your stand-up and put it on. And they made their first ever clip with me in it. And I was so excited that they got me to check everything was okay. And I was like, yes, but Marilyne, right? I was like, oh, there's one change to make with the subtitles. That's all great. They released it. I was like, oh my God. Because in the clip, I'm called Marilyne Roberts. And I just never thought to check my surname.
Check the tricky part.
Yeah, and I was like, but yeah. So but I think one of the reasons I called my show last year Marge was because whenever you're on the Ed Fringe website, if you just type in M-A-R-J, I'm the only person who appears.
Yeah.
Because it's such a weird name and it's such a weird collection. You never get those four letters together, M-A-R-J. So usually when you type M-A-R-J, should be enough for me to pop up.
That's perfect.
Depending on where you are in the world. Because if you're in the Netherlands, you're not getting
it's
me.
Coming up Well, I appreciate you taking the time. It's been a pleasure to sit down and chat.
Oh,
and I look forward to all that's ahead.
So nice to be on this podcast as well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There you go. That was Marilyne Robertson, to be specific. I think you will have all, if there's going to be a fair few listeners here who that's their introduction to Marilyne. And what an introduction, because I honestly think they are just a whirlwind of wonder and creativity and inspiration. I loved that conversation. I highly recommend you go and see Marilena, any of their upcoming tour dates there. They perform in London kind of 1 week of the month, you know, little open spots and things like that. So keep an eye out for stuff like that. But yeah, follow them on social media. M-A-R-J, Marge, O-L-E-I-N, I think. But if you put Marge, it will probably come up. Or Marjo. Yeah, that was wonderful. And next week's episode is another absolutely wonderful one. Honestly, I think it's a classic, Distraction Pieces. Really special, really emotional, but beautiful story to come next week. So strap in. And we've got loads of good ones to come. I've been recording with some fantastic people. You're going to love it. So until next week, stay safe and stay sane. Hang on, actually, before I go, full confession. About 3 weeks ago, I sent Buddy Peace, the greatest producer in the world, all the intros and outros for the whole of January. So I could be getting on with other stuff. He could be getting on with other stuff. On Tuesday the 30th of Jan, which if you're listening to this day it came out, he emailed me or messaged me at 7 p.m. to say, Pip, you did all these intros and outros. You didn't do an outro for Marilyn. Can you send me one now? So this is the hottest bit of audio that we've put out possibly ever. I mean, other than the Loki episode maybe, but what a turnaround. I'm recording this hours before you will hear it, which I don't know about you, but I find that incredibly exciting. Anyway, the more I talk, the more work he has to do. It's gone 7 p.m. on a Tuesday evening. So I'll be back next week. Until then, stay safe. And I mean, go over to the patreon.com/ScroobiusPip and subscribe and throw some money in, because that money often goes towards paying Buddy Peace, keeping this network up and running. So show that love. Anyway, blah, 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 blah. I'll be back next week. Until then, stay safe. And in fact, go and follow Buddy Peace on all the socials right now. No one listens this far into the podcast. So go and follow Buddy Peace, particularly on Instagram. Follow Buddy and put a comment on whichever picture you like saying thank you for all your hard work on the Distraction Pieces podcast, even at gone 7 p.m. on a Tuesday evening. Okay, I am actually going to stop now. Am I? Yes, I am. Right, I'll see you next week. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.